May it please the Court, Philip Gregory of Kitchett, Petrie & McCarthy for appellants. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of time, Your Honor. And I have with me in the courtroom Mr. Scarf, one of my clients. And obviously what happened here is Mr. Scarf found that through two entities, Scarf Sears and Pantoga Partners, a payroll scheme had been in place for a number of years where he lost, through the entities lost, rather, over $15 million was taken by the bookkeeper. The district court decided at the motion to dismiss stage that the allegations concerning that payroll scheme did not establish a claim for negligence. What's interesting about that is the district court said that because there was a contract both between Scarf Sears and the payroll firm and Pantoga Partners and the payroll firm, that contract limited the duties between the parties, and as a result, there was no possibility for a claim outside of that contract. As many California decisions have held, that is absolutely not the case. In fact, if you go back to even 1883 in a decision cited in the Northern Chemical case, there's a woman boards a train. She gets a contract with a ticket. The ticketing agent takes her ticket. Another ticketing agent comes along and says, you don't have a ticket, kicks her off the train. She's not entitled just to sue for breach of contract for the rest of the train ride, but she's entitled to sue in tort. And that's essentially what our Scarf Sears and Pantoga Partners should be permitted to do in the negligence claim. In Northern Chemical, there was a contract between a chemical company and a firm to bag toxic chemicals that were later going to be used for LCD screens. The chemicals are transferred pursuant to the contract to the outfit that puts them in the bags, but they contaminate those chemicals when they put them in the bags. They're then shipped off, and the company that's going to put the chemicals in the LCD screens finds the contaminated chemicals, brings a claim against Northern Chemical, and Northern Chemical then files an indemnity claim against the outfit that bagged the chemicals. And the outfit that bagged the chemicals said, well, we don't have there's no right in tort against us. The Court of Appeals said, absolutely there is. The contract did not specifically state that you were not going to put Northern Chemical's products in a contaminated vat. But in doing that, you violated a duty that is in tort. You took on a service, you performed that service improperly, and as a result, Northern Chemical was damaged. That meant that the Northern Chemical Company could state a claim in negligence. Further, recently, Judge Walker in the Northern District has said that a claim for breach of contract can also apply to a tort claim if the duty arises by virtue of a professional services contract. And Judge Walker's decision cites to attorney-client claims which state while the client retains the attorney, that may be a contractual relationship, but if the attorney breaches the duties owed to the client also has a claim for malpractice. Judge Walker's decision goes on to discuss home inspections and points out that these professional services contracts not only apply to the precise language of the contract, but provide a professional duty that goes beyond that contract. Here, the district court, in dismissing, stated that there was no duty outside of the contract. And that decision is clearly wrong, because defendants were obligated to use reasonable care in performing their duties for the SCARF entities. In the complaint, the fifth claim for relief details those improper acts. The payroll firms did not determine the extent of Wong's authority. They distributed excess payroll to Wong based on the payroll activity of other companies. They they provided Wong with guidance on how to stay under the tax radar, so that essentially when the tax withholding was done on the initial two paychecks, the grossly overinflated paychecks, they were at tax levels that were closer to what her true salary should have been. So instead of withholding taxes on, say, $100,000, they withheld taxes on $2,000. And again, they took on these duties. They disregarded their security procedures. They accepted bribes. Particularly, Vegholm accepted bribes that exceeded $80,000.
Is it significant that the defendants knew Mr. Scarf and knew that he was the individual behind the corporations, behind the partnerships?
That he was the general partner of the partnerships. If you look at the payroll services agreement, exhibits A and B to the consolidated complaint, it lists Mr. Scarf as a general partner. It lists Carol Wong either as a secretary or as a chief accountant, but does not list her as having any, I'm going to call it, ownership interest. Further, the testimony that was submitted at the summary judgment stage was they knew that Carol Wong was not an owner of the business. They knew the bookkeeper was not an owner of the business. And so I think it is significant that if you, as in the Torrance Bank case, you know you're dealing with a bookkeeper. He or she does something that is outrageous. I want to adjust my salary from $2,000 to $100,000. And I only want you to withhold taxes on the $2,000. And in fact, I want you to calculate how I can go about doing that. Is that something that should have triggered someone to say, that's improper conduct in approving that transaction? In fact, later at the summary judgment stage, the testimony that was submitted of the person most knowledgeable for the payroll entities said that we didn't have any transactions like these. These were extraordinarily unusual. In fact, they said that they did approve the transactions, but that they thought that it was a one-time, the woman who approved the transactions thought it was a one-time approval, did not know it was being done on an ongoing basis. Your Honors, I'm going to shift now to the court's ruling on respondeat superior. And I think it's important here that we have a division among the defendants. We have three of the defendants who are here saying that respondeat superior does not apply. We have one who says that it does apply. And here I want to point out that at the summary judgment stage, we have the declaration of Susan Story, again, the person who was the 30B6 witness for the payroll entities, and she outlines what was done here. She doesn't state that what the payroll people did was improper. She doesn't state they exceeded their authority. So, for example, in Lisa M., when you have the ultrasound technician taking advantage of the patient, they say that person exceeded his authority. Or in the FedEx case, where the packages were stolen, the contention is, well, no employee had the right to steal the packages. But the position that these parties took at the summary judgment stage was that what was done was what they were told to do. They did it appropriately, and everything was fine. It just happened to be extraordinarily unusual adjustments, but their view at summary judgment was, so what? They didn't come forward and say that what Vegholm or Chakotay did was acting outside the scope of their authority. So, for example, if it's not where an employee does something like in the Rogers case where employees are fighting among one another after having a significant number of beers, and they say those employees were not acting in the course and scope of their employment when they engaged in that fight. We don't have that record here. Further, we have Vegholm signing on to process the payroll for the scarf entities after she leaves the employee of these defendants. What the district court found here is that there was essentially no evidence that these two employees were acting within the course and scope of employment because what they were doing was they were engaged in an intentional tort. But simply because they were engaged in an intentional tort does not equate with an invalidation of respondeat superior. That's not part of the test. What the key part of the test is who should bear the risk of harm created by the employer's enterprise. And here again, we have a payroll firm. They're processing payroll all the time. These two employees are receiving what we believe are bribes, what they contend are gifts, on a monthly basis from the defrauding bookkeeper. As a result, appellants believe that the respondeat superior doctrine should not have been applied to this case. Finally, Your Honors, I want to deal with the issue of evidence of damages. Before the district court, through the declaration of Mr. Bass that was submitted at the time of defendant's motion for summary judgment, there were answers to interrogatories that had been prepared by plaintiffs. And these interrogatories primarily went to the issue of damages. And what they did in an answer to an interrogatory that laid out essentially how the damages were to be allocated among Pantoga Partners and Scarf Sears. And that was Exhibit 28 to Mr. Bass's declaration. That damage evidence was all before the court. At the time of the hearing, we had a number of summary judgment mat motions. We also had a motion to exclude evidence. And the court, the district court asked, where's the evidence of damages? I said, it's in the answers to interrogatories. The judge nods his head and moves on. The reason we say that is, under Rule 56, answers to interrogatories are properly available to consider as to whether there is an issue of fact. And here the issue was, Carol Wong stole over $15 million. If you give that the line of credit scheme funneled some of that money into Carol Wong's pocket, that amount of money was only $10 million. As a result, there is no question that from defendants, $5 million at least was taken. Thank you very much. I will reserve time for rebuttal.
Okay. Mr. Bass?
Your Honor, first of all, it's our...
I'm sorry, who do you represent, Mr. Bass?
I apologize. I represent defendants Intuit and Lisa Saccotti.
Okay. Are you speaking on behalf of all defendants here?
And Computing Resources, which is a subsidiary of Intuit. I'm going to be speaking on behalf.
Will you speak a little bit more loudly, please?
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize. I'm going to be speaking on behalf of Intuit, Computing Resources, and Lisa Sicotti.
Okay. Are the other defendants going to be represented here at oral argument?
I think the other defendant, which is Kelly Vakeholm, is going to cede her time to me.
Okay. And that doesn't present any conflicts in the argument?
I'm not going to argue on behalf of Kelly Vakeholm, Your Honor. I'm going to argue on behalf of my clients, okay. And I think that the argument we present, in our view, is sufficient to affirm the judgment below. I'm sure if the Court has questions specifically to Ms. Vakeholm's counsel, he is here.
Okay.
Your Honor, we view this appeal as something more like the equivalent of a request for a do-over than a legitimate appeal from the rulings of the district court. Much, if not most, of what has been presented to you by way of briefing and argument was not presented to the district court judge either in the context of the motion to dismiss, in the context of which the negligence cause of action, that was the fifth claim for relief of the consolidated amended complaint, was the point at which the negligence claim was resolved. More pointedly, in the context of the summary judgment proceedings in which the remaining claims were resolved, the intentional tort of aiding and abetting a fraudulent concealment and the conversion claim, which has since been conceded not to apply. That concession was made in the appellant's briefing here. And so if you look at the actual proceedings in front of the district court, if you look at Judge Fogel's ruling, you look at the what followed then by way of a request by the appellants to submit additional evidence and argument to Judge Fogel, and you look at his detailed response to that, denying that request, what the record actually contains is a remarkable dearth of evidence that would have been sufficient to give rise to a tribal issue of fact with respect to the summary judgment proceedings. There's a dearth of argument, legal argument, on the issue, for example, that you just heard about respondeat superior. That argument was not made to the district court judge initially in the summary judgment proceedings. We carried our initial burden. We cited decisions of this court, of the Ninth Circuit, as well as decisions of the California Supreme Court, which we believe now, governed and mandated the determination that in this situation, where you have an accusation that employees of a company are engaging in knowing intentional criminal conduct, clearly outside the scope of their authority, that the doctrine of respondeat superior does not then result in liability for the employer.
Well, there certainly are, Mr. Bass, cases all over California where intentional acts of an employee saddle respondeat superior liability upon the employer, where the employer has put the employee in a position and clothed them with the authority to do the acts which allow him to do the intentional torts.
No question about that, Your Honor. There's no question but that the landscape of respondeat superior jurisprudence in California is not simply a straight path. It is a complex and interesting area of jurisprudence. What we argued in moving for summary judgment before Judge Fogel was that the allegations, the record in this case, were much more like this Court's decision in Federal Express, in which the employees of Federal Express used their positions, used their entree to a area of an airport to steal product from the plaintiff. The Ninth Circuit said what they did, albeit it was certainly true that they were put in the position physically to perpetrate that theft by virtue of their employment with Federal Express, but what they did had nothing to do with the normal course of their employment, it did not benefit their employer in any way. Indeed, exposed.
But what your employee, the CRI, did was exactly what they were paid to do. The federal employer, the Federal Express people, used their Federal Express badges and their uniforms, et cetera, to get in and steal. But what your people did was to cut the checks to Ms. Huang for $100,000 a month. And, of course, the more checks they were cutting, the better for the company. The greater the money that they handled, the greater greater glory for the company.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, you lost me at that last phrase, because there's certainly nothing in the record, and it is not true, that CRI or Intuit benefited from the payments to the payroll.
Certainly, cutting checks for Ms. Huang was part of their job. Cutting checks for the payroll was part of their job. And in doing that job, they were misallocating funds from where the funds should have gone.
Well,
the fact that you do your job wrong means you aren't within the scope of your employment. I think that's an unusual interpretation.
No, and let me try to make a finer distinction, if I may. Certainly the fact if one does one's job wrong certainly doesn't take it out of the scope of your employment. The accusation here wasn't that they were doing their job wrongfully. It was that they were knowingly colluding with a thief. That was not part of their job. And so that, in our view, is no different from the Federal Express context. What they were doing, yes, their job was to take instructions, and I think this is important to appreciate. Their job was to take instructions from Ms. Huang, to take instructions twice a month as to the payroll for herself and other employees of the two companies, Scarf, Sears & Associates and Pintoga. That's what they did. They were accused in this lawsuit of having abused that position in order to aid and abet a fraudulent concealment of thefts by Ms. Huang. There was, by the way, no evidence that there was any fraudulent concealment of anything. In fact, CRI and Intuit sent regular full reports of all this activity, all the banking activity, all the payroll activity, to its customers.
Was there somebody who was monitoring these employees? Is there somebody responsible for auditing their books, sir?
Which employees are we talking about, Your Honor?
Cicotti and Vangholm.
They were in a chain of command at CRI. They had a supervisor, generally.
Was there anyone monitoring their conduct? I mean, when Ms. Vangholm took a gift the first time, she was told to give it back.
Correct.
And then she began to accept gifts regularly. She did not report it.
Correct.
Did any of her superiors ever inquire as to whether she was accepting gifts?
There's no evidence in the record to suggest that.
I gather it was not an appropriate act for an employee to accept a gift, because the first gift she got, she reported, and she was told to give it back.
Correct.
And then she didn't report them after that. Now, is there a duty of a company doing fiduciary type work to monitor the conduct of their employees?
That's a broad question, Your Honor.
To instruct the employees to report certain things?
If I might take issue with the characterization of the work as being fiduciary type work, it wasn't. CRI, Intuit, this payroll processor, they were not fiduciaries to Scarf, Sears & Associates or to Pintoga. There was no breach of fiduciary claim in this case. What they were is essentially a processing company. So rather than the companies doing their payroll in-house, cutting their own checks, they outsourced that mechanical
function. And you expect the people to whom you outsource to do it honestly. And there are certain standards that I think a company doing that type of work might impose upon its employees to make sure they were doing it honestly, not taking gifts, not taking unusual instructions.
Well, again, this notion that they were taking unusual instructions, and I'm not sure whether we're now talking about the negligence cause of action or the aiding and abetting fraud cause of action. As to the latter, it's important, I think, to focus on what the actual allegations were and what the claim was. What was left of that claim at the summary judgment stage was a claim of intentional tortious conduct on the part of my clients, that they aided and abetted a fraudulent concealment of the activity. The record before the district court on the summary judgment proceeding was that my clients sent full, complete, regular monthly reports, statements to its customers. Scarf Sears and Associates and Pantoga detailing everything that was done. Beyond that,
would that have shown that Wang was requesting checks for $100,000?
That it was absolutely known, and it was known for two reasons. One,
so that was part of the reports to SSA and Pantoga.
More particularly, Your Honor, these checks were written on the company SSA and Pantoga's bank accounts at Wells Fargo Bank. Wells Fargo Bank, completely independently of the reports that CRI sent regular monthly bank statements. Those regular monthly bank statements detailed, just as all of our bank statements detailed, every instrument, every check, every electronic transfer. Mr. Scarf testified. This was before the district court on summary judgment. Mr. Scarf testified when shown examples of the monthly statements, monthly bank statements from Wells Fargo Bank. He said, well, if I had ever looked at those, it would have been immediately apparent to me that there was something amiss. There was nothing hidden. There was.
And that's a good point. It's a fair point. Now, let me back up just a little bit. Ms. Wang had been working for Mr. Scarf for quite some time. At what point did your clients enter into the processing picture? What year?
I believe that, if I could give a bit of history, Wells Fargo Bank contracted with Scarf Sears and Associates and Pantoga to do their payroll. Sometime thereafter, Intuit, CRI.
Right. What year?
Your Honor, I apologize. Counsel tells me it was 1983. I'll take that.
That was my recollection. Ms. Wang's illegal activities began in 1991. Is that correct?
It's not at all clear when her illegal activities
began. We had an eight-year history of dealing between your clients and the scarf companies. Is that correct? About.
Yes, Your Honor.
In excess of 5 years, give or take a year. And during that point, as I understand it, Ms. Wang, there's no allegation Ms. Wang behaved illegally. As she was getting somewhere between $3,000 to about $5,000 a month for her own salary. At some point in 1991, those figures go up dramatically, and over the next couple of years, they increase to as much as $100,000 a month. Now, that may be showing up on Mr. Scarf's bank account. Is it also showing up in the internal reports at your clients? Is there anybody who's going to be able to? Is there anybody inside of your clients, an auditor, somebody who would supervise these employees, who would be able to say, "Hey, what happened here? We were authorizing $5,000 up to $5,000 a month in payroll for 8 years, and all of a sudden it jumps to $100,000. What happened here? That was a whale of a promotion."
Well, I don't think it was ever characterized as a promotion, but the best way I can answer that, Your Honor, is that there's nothing in the record to suggest or to indicate that there was a separate level of review or supervision or auditing, if you will, of their customers' payroll. What the contract with the customer says is, we're going to do your payroll, we're going to send you reports. If there's a mistake or error, call us, let us know, and then presumably it would be fixed or there'd be some explanation. But I would turn the question on its head, Your Honor. For years and years and years, my client had an ongoing contractual service relationship with Scarf Sears and Associates and Pantoga, and there was never any feedback from these customers saying, wait a minute, last week's payroll contains what must be an error.
If you're arguing that there was some a self-help remedy here for the scarf companies, that they're negligent in not checking their own books, that may be a very good argument. The question is whether there was any duty in your clients perhaps to alert them that there was a problem.
And our answer certainly is no, that our duty was contractual exclusively, that this was not a question of throwing a passenger.
And that question can be decided as a matter of California law.
Oh, yes.
Your clients have no duty.
That we had no extra contractual duty given the allegations, and I want to be precise about this, given what was alleged in the consolidated amended complaint, there was no factual allegation in the fifth claim for relief of that pleading that described or gave rise or created a duty of care, a negligence.
And that could be decided on a 12b-6 without further inquiry.
It could have been, and it was, and yes, Your Honor. And the cases we cite in our brief here on this appeal, I think, stand for the proposition that what the California Supreme Court now says is that when you have a commercial contract, the parties' duties and obligations to each other and their entitlements toward each other are defined by that contract, and it is not permissible to attempt to superimpose over that commercially defined contract a set of free-floating negligence or tort-type duties unless, and this is the important distinction, unless the plaintiff is in a position to allege that there was an intentional wrongful tort committed, that would essentially walk outside the four corners of the contract. And, of course, there was such a tort alleged here, the conversion tort, which has been conceded not to lie, and the aiding and abetting fraudulent concealment tort, which was disposed of on summary judgment, if I may, and I know I've been wordy here, long-winded, but I do feel I'd like to address the...
You're well over your time. I have consumed quite a bit of your time. I'll give you just a half a minute to summarize here.
With respect to damages, there was nothing before the district court on summary judgment to support a dime's worth of damages to Mr. Scarf, Scarf Sears and Associates, or Pantoga. Indeed, at the argument...
It's not quite true, counsel. The deposition of Huang, which you cited in your opposition to motion of summary judgment, showed that Ms. Huang was taking funds from Mr. Scarf's account.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And doesn't that show that Mr. Scarf was being damaged?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons.
Oh, you mean he's just getting a loan and he's sort of like Bear Stearns, he's never going to pay it back?
That's actually what happened, Your Honor, but I was going to make a nicer point, which was at the hearing, at the summary judgment hearing, Judge Fogel said to plaintiff's counsel, show me where any of the plaintiffs suffered damage. And the answer from plaintiff's counsel was, Mr. Scarf individually suffered none. It's not his money. Their contention was it's either Scarf Sears and Associates money or Pantoga money. There was nothing in the record to support that. The plaintiffs submitted nothing. And for them to say that, well, we submitted something that if you analyze it archaeologically, one could find something in their own interrogatory responses. We're entitled to submit those interrogatory responses. They're not entitled to rely on them. They did not satisfy Rule 56E requirements for an affidavit. And Judge Fogel, I think, rather dutifully and carefully explained in his two rulings, why it was that, A, it was not incumbent on him to comb through the record to try to find some evidence of damage when it hadn't been presented by the plaintiffs, and why he was not willing to do that even on the...
But she testified. Huang testified that she took money from the checking account of Scarf and put it in the Northcliffe account, and from the Northcliffe account paid back to CRI.
Exactly.
So it started from Scarf's account.
No, Your Honor.
You said that Mr. Gregory conceded, made a judicial admission, which bars him further from arguing the point, that there was no damage to Scarf, that it was not Scarf's money. Is that in the record? If so, can you give me a citation?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll give you a citation in a moment. And it was stated at the hearing on the summary judgment But let me just clarify. No one suggested that the money trail began with Mr. Scarf's bank account. It didn't. It began with Carol Wong's drawing down on lines of credit from financial institutions, Wells Fargo, Comerica, B of A.
A line of credit is a loan from a bank to whom?
In this case, to Mr. Scarf.
To Mr. Scarf. And he's liable on that. And when money comes out of an account for which he is liable, his balance sheet will show that his liabilities have gone up and his cash has gone down.
Yes, Your Honor. The question, I'm not going to quibble with that at all, but the question in this case, this was the core question in this case, is who was Carol Wong stealing money from? Was she stealing money from three financial institutions, or was she stealing money from Scarf and Scarf, Sears, and Pantoga? That's exactly what the nut of this case was about. And as it played out, for whatever reason, again, the plaintiffs, and I don't think they'll retreat from this here, they told Judge Fogel, we're not talking about Mr. Scarf's money. We're talking about SSA's money and Pantoga's money. And there was simply no evidence, for the reason Your Honor has just pointed out, that the money starts in Mr. Scarf's personal account. It is then laundered through other accounts, but there was zero evidence that that money ever belonged, a nickel of it, ever belonged to these entities, Scarf, Sears and Associates or Pantoga. There was a debate, an interesting debate, in front of the district court, whether the money that was very momentarily parked in Mr. Scarf's account was ever his money either, or whether Carol Wong had simply stolen it from the banks. Mr. Scarf took the position, understand this, Mr. Scarf's position in the litigation was, I never borrowed any money from Comerica or B of A or Wells. That was his position. That wasn't my money. And so I didn't have to pay it back.
But his debt.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Was his debt, because he had authorized Huang to draw down on the lines of credit.
But that was exactly what was being litigated, Your Honor. Mr. Scarf never conceded, he never agreed that he owed that money back. He was being sued by the banks and saying, I don't owe you anything.
Well, it turned out he did owe the money.
No, it turned out he didn't, Your Honor. He never paid it back.
Didn't he pay back $1.5 million to Wells Fargo in the settlement?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. None of the banks collected anything from Mr. Scarf. And I concede, I don't know that that's in the summary judgment record, but I will represent that to the court. Mr. Scarf never paid back any money to any of these banks. But the record, and again, I don't want to be too technical about it, but the record before the district court was that, A, it wasn't Mr. Scarf's money, and the site I'll give you is excerpt of record 2256, lines 11 to 13. This is referred to on page 11 of our brief. And in response to Judge Fogel's question, plaintiff's counsel, Mr. Scarf's counsel said, quote, Mr. Scarf's money was not used in the payroll scheme. It was Scarf's, Sears and Pantoga's money, close quote. That's what was said to the district court. I do think the district court judge could legitimately rely on that representation. This was not a careless, off-the-cuff remark. The question of whose money Carol Wong stole was at the core of this case from day one. Was it bank money? Was it Mr. Scarf's money? Was it SSA money? Was it Pantoga money? And it is absolutely the case. I want to be completely frank about this. It was our position on summary judgment. There's no question but that she stole lots of money. She went to prison. There's no question about that. What we sought to establish on summary judgment was that there was no evidence that a nickel of it belonged to Scarf, Sears and Associates or Pantoga or Mr. Scarf for that matter. And that was the record. That was the record before the district court on summary judgment, which is why I perhaps glibly refer to this earlier as a request for a do-over rather than appeal, because if you simply look at the record that was before the district court on summary judgment, it is very difficult, I think, to charge the district court judge with error or of ignoring any evidence. He made the right decision based on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gregory?
Would you address that last point?
Your Honor.
Was there any evidence before the district judge that it was actually Mr. Scarf's money that was being stolen by Huang? And if so, please give us a citation of the record.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think the first point to start off with is that Carol Wong.
No, please start out with that, with the answer to that question.
The citation for the payroll scheme is that the money started from Pantoga and Scarf Sears. And the fact that it included Mr. Scarf's money is Exhibit 28 to Mr. Bass' declaration. And that is, if I may, Your Honor, at it's Mr. Bass's declaration starts, Your Honor. It's 1304 to 1314, Your Honor.
Of what? Of the excerpts of record?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Mr. Bass started off by saying that it was just payroll that they were processing. That's not true. It was tax and payroll. They were doing tax reporting to the federal and state agencies, and they were adjusting the taxes consciously to stay under the tax radar. And they did so so that when the reports went to Scarf, Sears, and Pantoga, there would be no unusual payroll tax activity. And that's why they were different than your routine payroll processors, which is what Mr. Bass was trying to portray them as, is that they're simply order takers. They weren't simply order takers, and if the court could look at the declaration of Susan Story submitted at the summary judgment stage by defendants, it details the work that they did in processing the payroll, and that's particularly at the ER site 1326 to 1328. What they were doing is they were adjusting the taxes. And in terms of respondeat superior, as the case Mary M., the California Supreme Court case states, the determination of whether an employee has acted within the scope of employment is a question of fact. And this district court.
Counsel, I'm not sure that you addressed Judge Bea's question satisfactorily. So you gave us a reference in the ER and told us that the payroll scheme came from the Scarf entities. I think Judge Bea's question was, what evidence in the record is there that Mr. Scarf personally suffered from this scheme?
It's on that same, if I may, Your Honor, it's on the same page, because essentially, as Mr. Bass pointed out and as the flowcharts read, the money started from Mr. Scarf's account. It went through an entity called Northcliff, and then it went to either Pantoga or to Scarf Sears.
I thought what Mr. Bass said, and see if you can deal with this scenario, he said that the money that went to Northcliff wasn't Scarf's money, it was Wells Fargo and Comerica's money, because Scarf successfully defended himself against Wells Fargo and Comerica, claiming that Scarf had to pay them back the money that Huang borrowed through Scarf's line of credit from Wells Fargo and Comerica.
If
that is so, right, if Scarf didn't have to pay back Wells Fargo and Comerica for what Huang took out of those lines of credit, then Mr. Bass has a point, does he not?
If I may, Your Honor, may I answer that in two parts. One is, Mr. Scarf's in bankruptcy, and he had to go into bankruptcy because of what happened here, because of the banks. And the banks were attaching his assets, and this was all before the district court in the consolidated complaint.
He successfully established that he did not owe any money to the banks on his lines of credit.
If I may continue, Your Honor, Mr. Scarf then, in the context of both of this litigation and the bankruptcy, settled with the banks and did not, to directly answer your question, did not pay the banks as a result of the settlement, but he paid a lot of money to avoid having to pay the banks. But I want to go back to the core point, Your Honors, that the Wong stole over $15 million. The lines of credit with the banks did not even get to $10 million. There was an over $5 million delta that the defendants concede did not come from any bank, and it had to come from these entities.
Not whether it had to come. The question is, did you, A, allege, and, B, supply sufficient information for a reasonable trier of fact to find that it came from Scarf?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's
Those are the allegations. The 1304, 1314 will tell me that.
Yes, Your Honor, in a succinct fashion.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We thank counsel for the argument. The case is submitted. And with that, that completes the oral argument calendar for today. The court stands in recess until tomorrow. All rise.